us anyway. Oh, hi. Yeah. 24 seconds after the hour of 12 in this, the month of March, in the year of our Lord, 2006, thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day, live, I say, live and local, from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of Johnson 970, a proud part of the CBS radio family. Thank you for coming by. It is the Rick Emerson Show. It is Monday. It is Monday, March 27th. Yes. Monday, March 27th, 2006. We appreciate your radio presence and your patronage today. Hope you had a satisfactory and not too terribly dangerous weekend. If you'd like to get on board today with your comments, your clarifications, your conventions, your what have you, it is 503-733-2970. 503-733-2970. If you want to email today, you can do that as well. It is rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Sarah's just sitting in a chair scratching herself like a rabid monkey.
I am scratching my finger, Rick.
I'm just saying.
It itches.
Whatever you say. We'd like to give a special shout-out to Sarah Dillon's therapist, Wendy, today. Wendy, if you're out there listening, thank you for keeping Sarah somewhat stable and balanced. It makes the work day go by ever so much more pleasantly.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thanks. 503-733-2. We should just have a therapist day. We should just have a day where everybody's therapist comes up.
All the therapists hang out.
We shouldn't even do the show. We should just pick a day where we don't even show up, where the therapists just show up and they just do the show as us. We can go analyze patients' neuroses. They can come and they can talk about penis stories.
Fantastic.
That's good radio.
That's brilliant.
It's brilliant.
Are you getting your Mark Hamilton on there?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Maybe the station would sound better if I affected a British accent while I was, not that he's affecting his accent in any way. Mark Hamilton. Okay, in our case. Not that in any way that accent is played up or put on so it's to give them independent street cred. Sorry, something in my throat. Brilliant. It's 503-733-2970. Thank you for coming by. It is the Rick Emerson Show. And so forth. Coming up later on today, we're going to do a little Sopranos. Fantastic Sopranos last night, by the way. And I know as I speak now that I'm not the only one within the sound of my voice who listens, but I know that I am the only one in this room who listens. Because now Sarah doesn't even have cable. Is that we've reversed. Tim used to not have cable, and Sarah, you had, and now you don't have cable. Tim does, but doesn't watch the Sopranos.
Oh, I don't have HBO anymore. I took it out after Bill Mayer called it a fall and went off the air there into reruns.
But he's not. But he's back now. You're talking about Real Time with Bill Maher?
Right, right.
Yeah, he's back now. Boy, you know, that show, I don't want to get there. We'll talk about it later. I'd like Bill Maher in Real Time. He's one of those guys that I really, it's like you want to like him. Like, I remember with the old Dennis Miller show, when Dennis Miller used to do his show on HBO, and I so desperately wanted to like it. Whatever it was called, Live with Dennis Miller Live, Weekend Dennis Miller.
I never watched.
Whatever the hell his HBO program is called, the one where he did the, I don't want to get off on a rant here, Chico. whatever that was. Actually, I just like the idea of it a lot more than I like the actual show. Bill Maher, and I think I speak for everybody here, he does this show on HBO in front, and that's called Real Time, which is not, it's like you look at it on paper, and it seems like such a great idea for a program. Because it's like him, and then, you know, he has Arianna Huffington. Arianna Huffington, he is to Arianna Huffington as Adam Carolla is to, you know, Jimmy Kimmel or Sarah Silverman. It's just like the go-to. Like, I have no one. I have Arianna Huffington. It's like Arianna Huffington and Aaron Magruder. Like, those are his two go-to guests. But the only reason I watch that show is for the new rules section at the end. Mm-hmm. It's like 4 minutes long. It's the only part of the show everybody really likes.
What's amazing about that show is it's a nonstop hour. They take no breaks. They just keep going.
It just keeps rolling on through. But at a certain point, it just, like, it echoes all the worst traits of Politically Incorrect, which in turn echoed all the worst traits of so many of those panel shows, where it just ends up like being three people screaming at Michelle Malkin for an hour. And it's like, how often can I really watch that? Anyway, we'll talk about The Sopranos, which was fantastic last night. And I know that I've been saying that, but every week I kept, I keep expecting for it to fall apart. It's like with every season, we're on the sixth season now, I think, technically, The Sopranos. And you would think at this point the show would just be imploding quality-wise. But it has not. And last night was unbelievably good. So we'll talk about that. With Peter Carlin, we're also going to talk about the S.H.I.E.L.D. finale. And we're doing all this like 6 days delayed because we talked to him on Monday. The S.H.I.E.L.D. happens on Tuesdays. So we'll talk about the S.H.I.E.L.D. finale with him today. And then we're going to talk about Thief and Teachers, which are two. Thief is that new drama with Andre Brower of Homicide Life on the Street fame. He was also in City of Angels with Nicolas Cage. And we're going to talk about Teachers, which is a new sitcom starring Phil Hendry. And this is not, by the way, this is not my opinion. This is the opinion of I believe, the Oregonian when they call it an abysmal, unmitigated failure.
So it's zany, though.
It is. It is kooky. It is a rib-tickling, laugh-a-minute, slap-happy giggle-fest. Not unlike this program. So all of that is coming up with Peter Carlin. We'll talk about, we'll have a snuff watch. We'll do a Darwin watch, which are not the same thing today, although they could be. Clyde Lewis will be here to talk about news at Ground Zero. We'll discuss avian flu with our man in Atlanta, Ed McCarthy. And we'll find out which member of the Rick Emerson Show spent the weekend watching roller derby. That's all coming up, as well as your phone calls, your emails, and all that stuff. 503-733-2970, or you can email. It's Rick at RickEmerson.com. We have new music from Wing, by the way. Somebody sent me not one, not two, but five new Wing songs. And we'll not get to them all today. We will try to get to one of them today. We are joined today, as are we always, by the lovely Sarah X. Dillon, who is at the helm, the nerve center, the nucleus. She is the linchpin, the control. It fell apart there at the end.
Oh.
She's at the controls of the Rick Emerson Show. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We'll cut right to the chase. Sarah X. Dillon is the member of the cast and crew who spent the weekend watching roller derby. And how was it?
It was awesome. I want to participate. I want to knock some girls down and learn how to roller skate very well.
Get a hearty yes from me. This is one of those things we weren't able to discuss on Friday because Sean, who is our stellar engineer here at KLOL.
Stop.
At Johnson. Sean, let me understand this. So Sean is an engineer here during the day. And then he referees roller derby on the weekend. Have I got this right?
Uh-huh.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, he was awesome. He was just, he was one of the refs, going to try and keep the girls in line as they're knocking each other out of the ring.
Does he have to skate?
Yeah, he's a speedy skater, that one.
Is that on TV? Oh, it is on TV. Who does play-by-play for that?
I don't know. There were, a couple talking heads up there.
Does he have to wear satiny dolphin shorts when he does
it? No, he was wearing a referee outfit.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
All right,
and there was free beer.
Well, because most engineers, and you know this to be true if you work in radio, most engineers, they come to work, they do this, and then they go home and they just play endless World of Warcraft games while drinking heavily, and that's it. And making plans to execute everybody in the building one by one when they get fired. So if you work in a building where perhaps they've just fired an engineer or an IT guy, I'm just saying, I'd be coming in late and leaving early. Not that we know anybody who was in that circumstance. Anyway, so Sean does the engineering stuff here, and then he goes and he does roller derby on the weekend, which is genius. So on Friday, he comes and he hits me up with hey, are you interested in seeing some roller derby? And I said, am I ever? And then I wasn't able to go because my weekend was full, and I didn't. Tim, you don't strike me as the roller derby type. If I've misjudged you, please correct me.
You know, I used to watch it during the days of my youth.
And now?
Well, it's not on television now, is it?
All right, well, no, but you could go see it in person.
Oh, perhaps? I don't know.
Okay, well, I misjudged you. So, in any event, so Sarah went to see roller derby this weekend, and we'll talk more about that later on. Tim Riley's working on the following stories for your edification today.
I plan to crash into the White House, said Zacharias Massari, the man who can't even light his own shoes on fire. We'll have some top secret memos between Bush and Blair. Jeb Bush gets booed by some anti-war protesters, and thousands march in support of the impenetrable Mexican border over the weekend throughout this great land.
That's fantastic. That is all coming up, as well as today's top five. Today's top five, we will be doing the, and this was a listener-suggested top five, we'll be doing the top five songs that Rick Emerson, and there's really no way to talk about this without referring to myself in the third person. Top five songs that Rick Emerson listened to before he discovered rock and roll. These will be the top five songs he would find me listening to as a mere slip of a youth before I discovered all that was rocking in this fine world of ours. Once more, if you'd like to get on board, it's 503-733-2970. Ladies and gentlemen, back the hell up at the City News Desk. It's Tim Riley.
From high atop the bottom of the coin tower, downtown Portland, Oregon, CBS presents the City Desk Newsbeat. Tim Riley reporting. Al-Qaeda conspirator Zacharias Massari testified this morning that he and convicted shoe bomber Richard Reed planned to attack with a fifth airplane on 9/11 and fly it right into the White House.
Now, I'm confused about this. Now, I thought that these things happened months apart. I thought, that's what I get for just letting my brain go soft over the 11 months we were off. So, Zacharias Moussaoui, now, is he the guy that they arrested because he was trying to fly in 9/11? He was trying to get on a plane at 9/11, but he effed it up somehow and they caught him?
Yeah.
All right. But then Richard Reed, the convicted shoe bomber, that was weeks later, wasn't it?
Was weeks later.
So how were they planning?
It was on December 22nd. He was subdued by passengers when he attempted to detonate a bomb in his shoe on a flight from Paris to Miami.
Because I was in Kennewick when that happened. I remember being, because here's how I remember, and again, we've talked about this before, I am very kinesthetic in my memory function. Mm-hmm. I remember the shoe bomber being in December because I was at home in the lovely metropolis of Kennewick, Washington, and you and Bruce Agler were doing the news hour together, and I was on the phone from Kennewick talking about the shoe bomb guy.
Wow, you have a good memory.
I do. I remember the weirdest things, and I always remember it by dint of where I was. That's my whole mechanism, is remembering where I was standing, like what I was eating, what I was looking at, whatever. My point, though, is that those are months apart.
Mm-hmm.
So how is it that they were going to crash a plane together? These two things happened like 9 weeks apart.
That's a good question.
Aha! Discovered a hole in the news reporting this morning.
So I can't help you there.
Okay. Well, we'll just move on then.
Time for the Bush Watch.
He's the president in residence. He's kind of in charge. He's got the whole country saying, that's my Bush. Life is hard. That's the price of fame. When you're president, everyone knows your name. Hey, what's that thing? It's my Bush. I can't believe he's actually in the White House. That's our man. That's my Bush.
Off we go to the sound bites. A top secret memo indicates that President Bush was determined to invade Iraq in January of 2003, with or without a second UN resolution. The New York Times reports the memo came out of a meeting between Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said the Bush administration was continuing efforts to negotiate in January of 2003.
We were continuing to pursue a diplomatic solution, but we recognized that it was necessary to prepare and plan accordingly in the event we would need to use force.
McClellan rejected suggestions that the Bush administration has a credibility problem over Iraq. In a White House briefing, McClellan also disputed assertions that the administration did not anticipate and properly plan for post-war violence and sectarian comments. Meanwhile, McClellan said Bush is gaining ground on stopping illegal aliens from entering this country.
The new technologies that we're deploying along the border to help stop people from coming across the border illegally. And he also talked about some of the barriers we're putting in place, whether they're vehicle barriers or fencing in urban areas. Those are all important aspects, and we need to continue to build upon that. We've accomplished much, but there's much more to do.
Propping up a chair in front of the door between here and Mexico.
Please knock.
What new technology? We have Hispanobots or something? What new technology exactly is this that I... Exactly what improvements on the fence are they developing there that's going to... Let's talk about Scott McClellan for a minute. Because before it was Scott McClellan, it was Ari Fleischer, right?
Right.
And so Ari... And they all...
Whatever happened to him?
He's off drinking somewhere. And I don't mean that like... I'm not saying that as just a glib sort of witticism. He's off drinking somewhere. He has to be. Because being the press secretary for any White House, I mean, ever since... Really, they all pale after Ron Ziegler. Ron Ziegler was really the toppermost of the poppermost there. Again, I mean, because that guy handled, I mean, he went all the way through Watergate. He went all the way through all of that. I mean, he navigated that whole Nixon White House like it was just his own personal castle. So they all pale compared to Ron Ziegler. But it's the worst possible job you could ever have because especially working for this White House, because this White House is, I mean, they just have this strange relationship with the truth, and I understand that Bill Clinton was no saint there either, but I mean, you know, these guys have really stepped it up a little bit. It's just you have to stand up there and just sling this crap from the podium, and you have to look at the press, and you're lying, and they know you're lying, and you know that they know you are lying, and meanwhile, it's on a camera, and everybody, we're all out here, every guy with a microphone and a pen and a blog and a biro. And we're all sitting here waiting to take you apart piece by piece for spinning these fabrications in an unconvincing fashion.
It reminds me of the Chancellor in V for Vendetta.
Where they're just desperately, like, desperately trying to convince that there was no detonation. It was...
We had plans to blow up the courthouse.
No, there is...
We just forgot to tell you.
There is no terrorist.
And so did you like it, Tim?
It was excellent. It was cool. The best movie I've seen.
It's fantastic.
I agree.
Last year.
So fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It was
on so many levels.
Not perfect, but had a lot of really, really great things in it. And the things that I didn't like about it were very minor. But it's reminiscent of this, where Scott McClellan has got to stand up there at the White House briefing room and talk to the press. And it's the worst job because it's a terrible, stressful job that wears you down, just destroys your soul, gives you a drinking habit, completely decimates your brain, and yet you can't turn it down. Because they get all these guys from, you know, low-level PR firms, and a lot of them come from Hollywood PR firms. And when the phone rings, and it's them saying, would you like to work for the President of the United States? Like, in no world can you say no to that. You have to take it. So you take it knowing that it's going to be the worst 3 years of your life. And the proof of that is that nobody makes it through the entire term. None of the White House PR guys, they're like promotions directors in radio. They just get chewed up and spit out like a worn down pencil nub.
I've run out of lies.
That's totally what it is. I'm going to spend more time with my family's liquor cabinet. You know,
words are coming out of their mouths, but in their brain they're saying, I can't believe I'm really saying this in front of a group of people who I expect to believe me.
Absolutely. So he'll be gone soon.
In a speech about his past accomplishments, well, it turned into a discussion about the war on terror with Governor Jeb Bush, who was visiting the University of Central Florida. The governor patiently listened but disagreed to members of the Students for Democratic Society, or SDS, who asked about federal wiretapping programs and a host of military contracts with the university.
First time I've heard it. Don't think it's true. I don't think they're their daddy's SDS.
I don't understand anything he was just saying.
First of all,
he wasn't even speaking in full sentences there. He was just spinning out a bunch of... Let's hear that.
First time I've heard it. Don't think it's true. I don't think they're their daddy's SDS.
He can become president someday.
I don't even...
SDS? What?
Let's take things in order.
It sounds like some feminine product.
I thought the SDS was a holdover. I thought that was disbanded after the 60s. Wasn't the SDS... Or am I thinking of the Weather Underground?
You were thinking of Students for Democratic Society.
But weren't they... I thought they were still around. I thought they were gone, like everything else from the 60s.
No, apparently so.
Well, whatever. All right, so there you go. Whatever he said.
Meanwhile, you were complaining the other day that we don't hear from Donald Rumsfeld enough, so I went fishing.
Thank you.
And I have found Donald Rumsfeld, who was speaking in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Excellent.
I'm sure he's beloved there.
He'll be doing dinner theater somewhere later.
He says, the enemy in the war on terror may be the most brutal America's ever faced. And he says terrorists are capable of killing millions more.
Even today, some folks view terrorists as criminals, not as combatants. Some even consider them victims. Some seem to think that the years before September 11th were decades of peace. But that is not so.
No, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam.
You know, the great thing about Donald Rumsfeld is, like, if you just close your eyes a little bit and look into your mind's eye, you really could easily see his being the face that looms off a million flat-screen panels displayed all over the city, urging you to not think...
For your own safety.
Exactly.
Do not leave your homes.
Oceania will prevail. He has exactly the right face and temperament and speaking timber for that.
Mm-hmm. He wants to repeat, in case we've forgotten, terrorists are dangerous.
The enemy we face may be the most brutal in our history. They currently lack only the means, not the desire, to kill, murder millions of innocent people with weapons vastly more powerful than boarding passes and box cutters.
Yes, they
trust us to protect you and worship in the church of your choice. I would have loved to be an extra wearing a Guy Fawkes mask in front of that Parliament building where they were filming that movie.
Feminism is a mass psychosis. Yeah, and you said during V for Vendetta, you told me that's not CGI, that those are actually people in front of the
I would have done that
wearing
nothing.
The mask.
Exactly. Yeah. I bet everyone wanted to participate in that.
Yeah.
That was
I wonder if any of those masks are available on eBay since there were so many.
Yeah, that'll probably be the Halloween
mask. That should totally be the Halloween costume.
Yeah.
Should go as Guy Fawkes. It's funny because, growing up in Utah, one of Lara's best friends was from Britain, and she totally, every November, she totally did the remember the 5th of November, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, and I'm an idiot. I'd never heard of, I had no idea who Guy Fawkes was. I'm just an unwashed.
Michael J. Fox's brother.
Yes, I had no clue about anything. It's just a fantastic film. And I could have done without some of the sort of Matrix-y fight scenes at the end, which I felt were a little tacked on. But I mean, I would rather see a film that takes a big swing and hits like a solid, you know, it's like a solid third base hit, that film, rather than just see like some other crap spewed from the, you know, the mind of Michael Bay. So are we done with the Bushwatch?
This is the Bushwatch.
Are we
that
still
is,
in
it's
it?
The conclusion, no.
All right, there you go.
He's the president, resident, kind of in charge. He's got the whole country saying, that's my bird.
Stay tuned for further developments with your safety in mind.
By the way, I'd like to tell you that here's a story I probably don't even want to read because the headline sells it all. This is sent to me by Mike via Yahoo News. The headline really is the entire thing here. Drunkard kills himself over a meatless dinner. I don't know what the story is. I can't even tell you what the content is, but there's nothing that could possibly live up to those words strung together, so I'm just going to move on at this point. Here's Tim Riley at the City Desk.
Well, Airbus is describing an emergency evacuation drill of its new A380 Super Jumbo jet as a great success, despite dozens of injuries by passengers. One volunteer passenger broke his leg during the drill, and 32 others suffered minor injuries. The drill held in Germany was a critical element in the A380, which it must take to prove its airworthiness. About 850 passengers were successfully evacuated from the plane at 80 seconds. European and U.S. regulators will announce today whether the drill meets its safety requirements. Airbus hopes to have the A380 certified for public use by year's end. Time for the snuff watch.
Here's your snuff watch for Monday, right here on the Rick Emerson. Go.
Buck Owens, the flashy rhinestone cowboy who shaped the sound of country music with his act Naturally Song and brought the genre of television on the long-running Hee-Haw, died over the weekend. He was 76. Owens died at his home in Bakersfield, said a family spokesman, the cause not immediately known.
Seriously, I love Buck Owens, but I thought he died like 100 years ago.
I know.
I had no... I mean, is Roy Clark still alive?
No, he's dead.
Roy Clark is dead?
Yeah, I think he died last year.
Yeah. I wonder who else died that we did.
You Grandpa know, Jones? I wonder if he's still around.
Grandpa Jones died. He died like 4 years ago, but he was the guy who everybody thought, you know, everybody assumed that. I mean, I figured he was dead even before the show went off the air, but no, he actually only died like 3 or 4 years ago. Minnie Pearl died like 10 years ago. I think she died when I was in... Let's go through every Hee-Haw cast member.
What about
name.
Junior Samples? Is he still alive?
And what about the... There was that woman that
String
looked like
Bean?
That woman that looked like Lulu Hogg. And then let's just have a lot of Hee-Haw talk, shall we? And then we'll play that Carrie Underwood song some more. You remember that girl on Hee-Haw? She was like the young blonde. I don't know. She had like a Jamie Presley thing kind of going on. You know what I'm talking about? No, Sarah, of course, never watched Hee-Haw. Tim has probably tried to block it out of his brain.
I remember it.
Anyway, there was a girl, she always sat on the front porch with like a beagle or a basset hound. One of the two. I can never remember which is which.
Lulu Roman?
No, she wasn't a Lulu. No, Lulu, wasn't Lulu a huge fat brunette woman?
Oh, I think you're right, yeah.
I have no idea what we're talking about.
Meanwhile,
Buck Owens dead.
Yes. Meanwhile, the uninflatable Owens played in a red, white, and blue fashion with fireball fervor. That according to his obituary. He and the Buckaroos wear flashy suits. Buck Owens is dead.
Did you... Listen to that. That's news that's direct and to the point. And did you see that photo? There was on CNN that the press photo they were using of him is from like 1958, and it's them in a bunch of like peach-colored, rhinestone-covered suits.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, for people who think that gaudiness is a recent development in country music, you are wrong about that.
He apparently never underwent plastic surgery.
He really does look like a vastly aged version of Howdy Doody. Like, if you put Howdy Doody in some sort of scientific chamber and sped up the aging process by, like, a factor of 50. I used to have a general manager that looked just like that.
He truly baked in Bakersfield. But he'll be missed
okay.
by us all.
There's your snuff watch. Let's go ahead and carry on. All right, there's a whole lot of Hee-Haw talk I could do, but I'm not going to do that. All right, we'll be back after this. It is the Rick Emerson Show. It's 503-733-2970. Coming up later on, Clyde Lewis with news at Ground Zero. Darwin Watch later on, Peter Carlin from the Oregonian. And the top five songs Rick Emerson most frequently listened to before he discovered rock and roll. You stay there. All I gotta do.
just act naturally. Well, I'll bet you I'm gonna be a big star. Might win an Oscar, you can't never tell. The movie's gonna make me a big star. Cause I can play the part so well. Well, I hope you come to see me in the movie. And I know.
All right. It's the Rick Emerson Show, 503-733-2970, 503-733-2970. Thank you for coming by. It's Rick at RickEmerson.com, by the way. You know, Buck Owens does really have the cut. You would never be able to be a country star with this face today. This really is a pre-television kind of star we're looking at right here.
When you listen to the Grand Ole Opry...
Seriously, this
every
is
Saturday night after.
You're tuning in to WNS.
Someday, maybe we'll see him in person.
Thank you for coming along. Coming up here later on, we have Darwin Watch. Good heavens, that's loud. Let's make that go away. Thank you. Listen to that. Okay, coming up later on, we have. The hell do we have? We have Peter Carlin from the Oregonian. We're also going to do today's top five. Songs I most frequently listen to before I discovered the glory of rock and roll. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show, CNN radio correspondent based in Atlanta, Mr. Ed McCarthy. How are you, sir?
Hey, Rick. How you doing today?
You know, we got to get you. Didn't we used to have a theme song for you, too? Didn't we have Georgia or some such music?
Yeah, you had something. It was funny.
All right. I got to hold on. Let's see. How do you feel about the Starland Vocal Band?
I like that.
All right, excellent. Good to go. Okay, that'll be your theme. Hey, let me ask you this. I was looking at the CNN thing today, and they got you. You're the man, apparently, who knows this. What are the odds that I'm going to die of bird flu in the next year? Would you say they're 50-50, greater, less?
Yeah, you're not going to die of bird flu. But we probably will, because they'll probably send us where it is. They want to get rid of us, you know?
Excellent. Good. It's good that you got a good attitude about the whole thing.
Well, see, and there's a new survey out on this thing, and, you know, it's going to creep closer, they say. You know, first of all, when this whole thing came out, I thought it was like Y2K.
Right.
That's what I thought it was. And I said, I really don't believe this thing. But the more and more doctors you talk to, they think it's going to happen. Well, the bird flu, it's spreading from bird to bird now over in Europe. So now this new survey's come out, about 760 doctors think that it is likely that avian bird flu will reach the U.S. That's about 86%. More than half of them, about 55%, believe it's very likely bird flu will reach the U.S. Now, the thing of it is, most of these doctors don't think the government's ready to do anything about it when it gets here.
Well, what is it they would really do? I mean, you can't, unless we all just want to walk around with those, like, cages on our heads, there's really nothing we can do about it. We're all just going to die if we're, you know, from it, if it comes here, aren't we?
Well, they had it in 1918, and a lot of people did. Thousands of people died.
Excellent.
But what they're looking at is to try to get some kind of a vaccine, which they don't even have right now. So their big concern is that it goes from human to human. It would, you know, go from the bird flu. Somebody would get the bird flu, and then it would transmit from one human to another. Well, that's not happening right now. So they've been pretty lucky. They've been setting up all these quarantine centers and airports and trying to get everything ready. But, you know, the whole thing is, you know, is the government ready? I mean, the thing you look at, you say, God, they didn't really do such a great job with the flu shots last year. This year they had a mild flu season, so they were okay. So they had a glut of vaccine. But, you know, when something like this happens, you get a little nervous.
So let me ask you this. And I regret asking this question even before I do it. Does the government have any? Is their plan just for everybody to carry a pocket full of posies, or what really is their strategy on this?
Yeah, they were talking about that Tamiflu, but I mean, is that going to work? I mean, if they get more of that, they don't even know if this thing mutates, what it's going to be like. That's the problem right now.
Oh, great. Well, okay. As long as I don't have anything to fear.
Don't grow feathers, and you'll be all right.
As long as all their priorities are in the right. I floated this idea a couple weeks ago of, because somebody in the administration made some comment, well, you just can't put a whole cage over the country. But really, it seems like that's probably our best bet at this point. We just cover the entire country in mesh and chicken wire. Well, look, I mean, Reagan wanted to do it with Star Wars. This is really just like one or two steps down from there. Sort of a Star Wars meets like a Saturday craft festival kind of a thing.
So Well, it's if you see a goose duck, I guess that's what it'll be.
Why don't we cure the birds first? Put some serum in worms?
Is this a thing that doesn't kill? Is the problem that it doesn't kill birds themselves, and the birds just happily walk around with it, and then it just kills us?
Yeah, it seems that way. That's the thing.
Let me ask you this, Ed McCarthy of CNN Atlanta. Is it possible that the birds are plotting against us?
Well, you never know. Maybe Osama's got the birds on his side. You never know.
That's all I'm saying. I don't want to be walking around like Tippi Hedren just waiting to be taken down. You know what I mean?
That's right.
All right. CNN radio correspondent Ed McCarthy in Atlanta. Thank you, Ed. All right. There you go.
Things ripping people's eyeballs out.
Seriously.
Flying around whistling songs.
Next thing you know, I'm having to board Rod Steiger up in a room somewhere.
Well, here are the Oregon possibilities for this. The Oregon plan envisions two possibilities. A moderate epidemic that would kill 2,700 Oregonians. So these people wouldn't be missed, really.
No.
Or a monster would kill 24,000.
Yeah,
so depending. Now, by contrast, 600 Oregonians, most of them elderly and infirm, die every year without the birds.
Well, I was going to say, so these are just people, you know, they're on their way out anyway. They're on the short list as it is now. You know what I mean? And I mean, it's just all just going to be people in my neighborhood that would normally, you know, all they would be doing is staying alive to scratch off tickets and sell meth. That's it, man.
Now, a moderate pandemic would hospitalize 11,245 Oregonians. Don't ask me how they got that figure. Of that number, 845 would require ventilators and 1,600 probably those little scooters. Okay. Severe epidemic, worst-case scenario, would be far worse. 128,700 would need hospitalization, 9,646 would need ventilators, and 19,305 would need intensive care.
Yeah, but think about how much less gridlock there'd be. You know, this is not one of those. It's not like in a stand, you know, or something where everybody would just die on the highway and then I'd have to be taking a skateboard to work. This is just enough to lighten up the load on the infrastructure here, as far as I think about it.
But so far, only 186 humans have been killed so far. So what's the big deal about this?
All right, there you go. All right, it's 503-733-2970, 503-733-2970. Here's Tim Riley at the City Desk.
Meanwhile, Patti LaBelle struggled through a weekend show after taking the stage at midnight in Florida, and at one point sitting down and crying.
Tell me there's footage.
I'm afraid there is not footage. I've never been this embarrassed in my life, said Patti to the crowd Saturday at the Riviera Beach Jazz and Blues Festival. This sucks. It's the worst show I've ever done in my life.
We know your pain, believe me.
As temperatures dipped into the low 50s, LaBelle explained she's nearly 62 and has diabetes, a heart murmur, and cold weather just simply doesn't agree with her. She tried to belt out a few notes, but told fans huddled under blankets that she would understand if they walked out on her right now. So a steady stream of people did just that. They stood up and walked out.
Oh, that's genius.
I've never given you less than I can give. I'm going to give you everything you deserve, which was nothing. And everybody left. She struggled through Lady Marmalade with assistance from a few in the crowd. They tried to help her along, but to no avail. Then she sang some gospel song before retreating.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's fantastic. Really, the question has to be asked, who shows up hours early and huddles under blankets to see Patti LaBelle?
Did you ever sing Lady Marmalade? Oh, that was a big hit way back when.
Yeah, but that's it, man. She didn't sing. Who sang the I'm So Excited? Is that hers at the Pointer Sisters?
That was the Pointer Sisters.
So she got the one song.
One. That's all you need.
That's it.
That's all you need to get people to huddle under blankets in the rain.
And then she sat down and began weeping on stage. Oh, that's fantastic.
I've never been so miserable in my life.
Oh, that's the best story I've ever heard. Oh, my God. It's just the image of Patti LaBelle trying to sing Lady. She can't even do it. She's getting the crowd, like, Hagar style.
They're all standing there eating cotton candy and hot dogs.
Yeah, some guy with a funnel cake trying to warble out a few notes of Lady Marmalade.
Come on, everybody, let's all sing.
She just begins openly weeping. Oh, my God. Oh, it's fantastic. Seriously, somewhere out there, somebody was filming it. That's going to be on YouTube by the end of the week, and I am asking y'all out there to find it and send it to me so that we might mock her suffering.
That would be fun.
Good times. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson Show. God damn. Clyde Lewis.
Sorry.
What would you give to see Patti LaBelle just weeping on stage?
I would love to watch that.
After failing to get the crowd to sing along with her.
I've got a blue attitude, basically. seats
oh,
of it.
Oh, God.
They start singing and crying. And
oh, it's good.
this is the worst performance I've ever done. You can walk out now.
They were happy to oblige.
Just trying to sing Lady Marmalade through her tears in the Florida rain.
That just screws up everything else.
No, that's fantastic. Well, no, that's a fate that waits for us all. Look, I'm telling you, man, it's you give Dana Carvey another 10 years, you'll be able to pay him 50 cents to do the church lady routine at a state fair somewhere. You know what I mean? So, oh, that's good times.
That is just painful.
Well, all right then. Well, everything's going to pale after that. But what's up in the world of Clyde Lewis?
Hey, you guys were talking about the avian flu there for a while.
Yes, we were.
I've got what they're going to do, if you want to know. I wrote an article about this about a year ago, and it was published in, like, the Idaho Observer, and it was about the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and what that is that they will, if we have an epidemic of the flu here in this country, they will tell people that they are required by law to get examined, and also they will track every drug purchase. They will mandate that all healthcare providers report all cases of persons who harbor any illness or health condition that may be caused by an epidemic or an infectious agent, and it might pose a substantial risk. They will also have on airplanes, they will be giving you, you know, how they do a charter thing for boats and stuff. They will make a manifest, and right. You will have to write on the manifest that you have a certain disease, and you have to report every disease, every malady, every problem you have before getting on a plane and flying out.
Good times.
Can't you see them putting blindfolds on people and leaving them to a mass grave? For your own safety. For your own safety.
The plane.
Don't look. They walk them off the boat, or they walk them off the plane.
The plane's Patty LaBelle entertaining.
Yeah, exactly.
The plane's destination is just the sun.
Oh, I just have leprosy. Well, for our entertainment tonight, we're going to watch old John over here rot.
It's like that. It's like.
Hello?
Hi.
Just rot.
It'll be like that Simpsons episode. You'll be on the plane. You look, and it's like Dr. Laura on one side and Spike Lee on the other as they're shooting the rocket into the moon.
Exactly.
Jesus. That's good times. Now, are you going to be talking about this tonight?
Dante's? No. Yeah. I've talked about this for a while. I'm going to talk about Guilty Conscience.
Yeah.
And the reason why I want to talk about it is because everybody's saying that movie, V for Vendetta, is about the Bush administration. And in reality, it's not. It's about, it was written at the time of Margaret Thatcher.
Yes, it was.
And
if you look at the imagery in the film, the imagery is primarily Nazi, and it's also Lenin-esque. I mean, if you take a look at John Hurt, he kind of looks like Vladimir Lenin.
Well, the British are still angry about Margaret Thatcher. I mean, that's been, what, 15 years?
Yeah.
Something like that. And they're still just like, she screwed that
country. She took away milk from children.
Yeah, exactly. That was the coffee people trivia question this weekend.
It was what
European leader was accused of taking milk from children. And it was I didn't even have to think about it. I've never even been to Britain in my life. Without even thinking about it, I pulled up and like, Margaret Thatcher, like, yes, you get a free punch.
Well,
so,
the whole attitude of this film was spread throughout Argentina and England because of the Falkland Island War and the idea that we were killing people and everything for land. And they were using terrorism as their modus operandi. They were saying, well, there are terrorists here in Argentina. There are terrorists here in England. They're threatening us. We need to go and do something. And so all this stuff was done prior to 9/11 and prior to, you know, what's going on in this country. So that's why when I came back from South America and I was aware of what was going on in England and I wanted to do Ground Zero, from that standpoint that, you know, this is what's happening over there and it could come over here if we're not careful. Well, now it's come over here and now people are beginning to go, oh, well, isn't this movie about the Bush administration? No. It's not, but the guilty conscience factor is involved here, and people are beginning to go, oh, this reminds me a lot of our administration. Well, it's because, you know, it's beginning to spill over, and we're beginning to experience this, all of us together, in one big, happy family, new world
order. I hope you all get masks.
What's that?
Tim wants us all to wear Guy Fawkes masks.
I would love to wear them. I mean, and another thing, too, is there's some strange imagery in the Guy Fawkes mask that people are talking about. If you look at his eyes, they have the Christian fishes.
Oh, really?
In the eye. If you take a look at the eyes of the mask, and people are saying that actually it was a subliminal thing of Christianity because of the fact that Guy Fawkes was a Catholic and that all that was, like, subliminal. And there's also the Cross of Lorraine that is the symbol of the fingerman, and the Cross of Lorraine is symbolic of tuberculosis and cancer and all that stuff. And it's basically the idea of the disease of fascism and how it spreads from person to person to person. So there's a lot of strange symbolism in the film that I want to talk more about, but I don't want to reveal too much until people see the film.
Well,
and and then I can talk about it more.
All right, hold on a second. Who, let's see. Hi, Rick Emerson Show. Who's this?
Hey, this is Steve.
Hey, Steve, you have a question for Clyde.
Yeah, quick one. Two quick questions. One of them is, do you think that any of these viruses they're talking about, that it's possible for them to ever get airborne? And the other thing is, God, it's good to hear your voice, Clyde. Are they ever going to give you your radio show back? We miss you.
I don't know. I mean, I'm online right now.
Clyde's busy molding young lives.
I'm online right now doing my show. I do them every week, and also you can download them at any time on podcast. As far as if this can ever be airborne, keep in mind that it was the United States of America that scientists in the United States that basically resurrected this virus. They did it. They synthesized it in a lab, and they finally resurrected it. And the strange thing is that they had no reason to resurrect it, and they did. And if another country were to have done that, we would probably bring them in on bioengineering or at least a bioterrorism. So I find it interesting that we are the country that is resurrecting this disease and this virus, and we have we had to do it for a cure. So they knew a long time ago this was going to happen.
Really, the answer, Steve, is that yes, you will be bleeding out of every orifice very soon. So
I'm going to cross between a man and a bird that was created during the.
What about Mant? All right, Clyde, what time does everything happen at Dante's tonight?
Well, I'll be there tonight at 8 o'clock speaking, and we have a pretty good crowd. Lately, though, the crowds have been fairly active. I had a guy that almost was going to climb on stage and beat the holy crap out of me on stage. So, I mean, it gets pretty. Sometimes it gets weird. Sometimes it gets it's kind of subdued, and so it's not bad.
Well, when all else fails, just lead the crowd and Lady Marmalade sing along, and then
or blindfold them and have them walk off the plane into a mass grave.
All right, Clyde Lewis, ladies and gentlemen, ClydeLewis.com. All right, man. There you go. There's Clyde. All right, good times. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Tim Riley at the City Desk.
It's time now for the Darwin Watch.
Here's your Darwin Watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson.
I have a feeling some bad stuff is about to go down.
This comes to us from Florida. Paul Dana was an up-and-coming rookie driver living his dream. A former motorsports journalist who was hours away Sunday from becoming, well, from having his most promising season yet. But before the green flag flew, something went terribly, inexplicably wrong.
Inexplicably wrong. It's a total shock to everybody. One minute he was just speeding around an oil slick track at 200 miles an hour, and the next minute he was inexplicably dead.
Then it says, while streaking around, apparently he wasn't wearing any clothes, around the Homestead Miami Speedway Oval during a warm-up session, Dana failed to notice that another car had spun to a stop, slamming into it at an estimated 175 miles an hour. 2 hours after his shattered car came to a rest, the 30-year-old Dana was pronounced dead at a hospital.
By the way, I can't take credit for that last remark. I saw somebody post that remark online early today, but it really is true. It is, I mean, everybody sort of tries to, well, I don't know, that's just fate. That's just God. When your time is up, God will find you no matter what you're doing. Speeding in a circle at 200 miles an hour on a piece of cement covered with oil filled with huge gas-filled cars. I don't understand why everybody thinks the X factor is here, but, you know, whatever.
Well, if any other drivers had jitters before going into the race, it didn't show by the end. With several carrying off a side-to-side tire-bumping duel in the final laps en route to the thrilling finish. Right. 2 days before his death, the first in the URL in 3 years, Dana was strolling through the paddock, shaking hands and signing autographs. I can't wait to get started because I want to prove to everyone I can do the job, Dana told a longtime acquaintance. I'm feeling better now and know I can race with these guys, and now I've got great equipment.
So it's actually an ironic death as well.
Dana's wife, Tanya, was in Indianapolis with a couple living, was notified of her husband's death while in church. Paul was on cloud nine after getting the ninth spot
Paul
in Sunday's
race. Paul was on cloud nine. Does it really say that he was on cloud nine?
He was on cloud nine.
And now he's on cloud ten.
Executive director of the Ethanol Promotional and Informational Council. His spirits were at an all-time high. He's been elevated to a greater place.
did you see the video clip of it?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's a bad scene, man. It's It's perhaps the, I mean, anybody is unclear about the fact that driving in an oval at 200 miles an hour is perhaps not necessarily like the safest thing you could be doing. This video will clear that up for you. So, I mean, it really does seem like it's one of those things that's just an eventuality. You saw it, right?
Well, I saw the replay. So was it the guy who got squished, or was it the guy that did the squishing that died?
It was the squisher, not the squisher.
Oh, the squisher.
The guy who got hit is still alive, I think.
He which is? Is and he, I thought
like
that was the dead
ankle
guy.
Or something? No. Because what happened is they're all racing. And this was a... Is it true that this was a test race?
I believe so.
Oh.
Well, I guess you failed.
Oh, Rick.
It is a pass-fail. It's a rather binary system. Anyway, so they're speeding in a circle, 200 yeah. miles an hour. One guy hits a wall. He hits a wall, and I'm not talking figuratively, like when you're jogging and I'm hitting the wall. No, I mean, he hit a wall.
He careened into the wall.
He careened yes. into the wall. He caromed off a wall. Back out into the track, and the deal is, I don't know, we'll talk to Dennis Pitzenberger, he's on the line. We'll talk to him in just a second, but my understanding is, and Dennis can clarify this for him, is when a guy hits a wall and then he starts what they call the drift, where he's drifting into the lane, and they get on the radio, because those guys all have headsets and closed circuit, and they get on there and they go, there's a guy drifting, you know, racer in the lane, or whatever. They, you know, look out, don't hit him.
What if they're listening to, like, an iPod?
I think they're, so if you're busy, yes, if you're busy listening to, you know, to this show or whatever. So they tell all the racers, like, look out, there's a guy, and this, what's his name, Dana?
Dana
was a race car
yeah.
driver. So he like doesn't hear it or doesn't pay attention or whatever, and he's just like speeding around like doo doo doo. Boy, I'm sure looking forward to the wham, you know, and just right into the guy, right into this wrecked car. And the guy who got hit, as I understand it, is still alive. I think. I don't think he's
dead.
Well,
yeah. This morning I heard whoever the other guy was. It was like awake.
Yeah, but this Paul Dana guy, took him out with a dustbuster. He's hella dead is what he is. Let's talk to our good friend Dennis Pitzenberger. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. I think automotive commentary has been taken to a new level with the squisher or the squishy.
Well, look, I'm sure there's some technical term for it, but that's what the people at home are calling it. The guy who got hit and the guy who hit.
Yeah, it was really unfortunate. It was just one of those things you called it practice, but it was the inside story that I've got is that there were some communication problems, and that's why he didn't really get the signal in time and know that there was someone else that had already wrecked on the track in front of him.
Well, maybe he didn't have his emergency flashers on.
No, maybe he had OnStar. You know, this would have been avoided.
He was playing with the stereo at the time, I think, possibly what he was doing.
So it was a test race, and he hit that guy at 180 miles an hour, something like that?
Yeah, it was something like 180, 190, and it was a practice session. So, again, it's not, when you're talking about racing versus practice, there's maybe more alertness of what's going on the track because they think that they're not racing with 30 or 40 other guys out there. But
yeah.
It's an unfortunate thing, but the squishy and squisher, I'm feeling that officially.
We're trying to color up the lexicon.
Okay,
my friend.
You can have it, Dennis.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Dennis Pitzenberger, ladies and gentlemen. All right, there you go. So, I can't really elaborate anymore. The article's really done all for me. There's your Darwin watch for. Oh, no. What are you doing there?
Well, it's similar.
I guess technically speaking, it is.
Which death watch? Okay.
It is a snuff watch. There we go. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Another one bites the dust.
Don't.
Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey.
We're all whispering at once.
We can't talk to each other anymore.
No, our talkback function is...
Yeah, we've got to learn how to be better lip readers.
I got to learn sign language or something. I was going to say, do we want to do one more and then break?
Yeah, and I was telling you that we'll be a little late, but we could if you want.
Late. Let's not. Thank you. Okay, let's do one more here.
All right.
Let's do one more story. Okay, then we'll take a break. Now this comes to us from Nebraska.
Well, Skyla Bartels, a Drake University of sophomore from Harvard, Nebraska, has spent his spring break living inside a Walmart store. He wandered the supercenter in Windsor Heights for 41 hours, subsisting on Walmart products. The best place for dozing was London Garden, where the lights weren't so bright. There was nobody working there between 2 and 4. Bartels found a chair, kicked back, and wondered how could life be any better in Nebraska. Life would be perfect, he discovered, without the worker who showed up before dawn to stock plants. He hopped up and pretended to be looking for home patio furniture. That 1 to 4 a.m. shift is a daily low point.
How could life be any better in Nebraska? This is, so he just decided to live in a Walmart just to amuse himself?
Yeah, he's
wasn't there
he's
a children's book like this?
No, there was a movie where, well, Natalie Portman,
oh,
when she
gave
birth. Oh,
that's Anywhere But Here.
Yeah.
Was it where they lived in a Walmart?
Well, she did for a while.
All right.
She birthed her baby America
did you ever,
there.
When you were a kid, did you ever want to do that, though? When you were a kid, didn't you ever want to live in an apartment store? Or live in a... Wasn't there some children's book, though, where some kids lived in a... No, it was a museum. There was that children's book where the kids live in a museum. And I forget exactly what museum it is. I think they live in the Museum of Natural History in New York. Well, never mind. Anyway.
Well, he was sitting on the floor reading a magazine at 3 a.m. when a man shivering from the cold walked in, bought an atlas, and left. You see, a lot of people are reading. Cosmopolitan was a huge favorite. But nobody ever checked the magazine section. I never saw anybody stocking books or magazines at Walmart.
All right, I stopped listening halfway through. Rick, can we go back to making fun of retarded and disabled people? Enough
sure.
with the bird flu. I had to throw away my leftover fried chicken because of you, you bastard. Sure, I'll find it. We'll find some disabled stories.
I think it's time for a break. We're going to take a break now. Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes. This is Ronnie James Dio. Rock.
Don't go anywhere. It's the Rick Emerson Show.
Back into this. Holy diver. Stay right there.
Holy diver. You've been down too long in the midnight sea. Oh, what's becoming of me? Ride the tiger. You can see his stripes, but you know he's clean.